Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back a renowned astronomer, Bob Berman, to the studio to field all of your astronomy-related questions. A fun guest to have. It's snarky at times, but he knows what he's talking about, and he'll make it seem easy enough for you and, me to understand. The number to call, and I suggest you call early, because what'll happen is we'll get an esoteric question about the meaning of the universe, and then it's off to the races and you can't get in. So call now while there's an open line or two, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/voxpop, or you can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/WAMC Radio, or you could tweet your questions at WAMC Vox Pop, or email us, of course, at voxpop@wamc.org. Phones work as well. 800-348-2551 is the number. All right, Bob, we've dispensed with the preliminaries. Nice to have you back.
Great, Ray. Great being here. What does snarky mean, by the way?
Well, you know, a tad sarcastic.
Really?
Cutting at times, but...
Am I?
Well, I think you are at times, yes. Well, I think you're the snarky astronomer, and that's good.
We'll see.
You know, humorous and at times, biting, you know.
I don't think of myself as biting. I'll have to watch it. Okay,
let's, though. No. Yeah. Continue. Usually it's at my expense, so it works out pretty well. Now, the sun is ready for a flip. This is everywhere, but it was on our website today. Our nearest star is about to pull a once-in-11-year move by swapping its north and south magnetic poles. Your most recent book is The Sun's Heartbeat, and I know you covered this to some extent. Explain what's going to happen and why we should not be petrified.
Right. Poles flipping, for some reason, in the last 10 years has gained a lot of notoriety, especially in New Age circles, usually in terms of Earth's pole flipping. Some think that Armageddon is going to follow that, even though Earth's north and south change places every, 300,000 years on average.
Yeah.
And it never harms us. The sun's poles flipping sounds like a big deal, and in a way it is, because the sun calls the shots here. You know, that's our nearest star that controls life on Earth, that controls the solar system. But underneath the headlines, it's a little less scary, because this happens, as you said, every 11 years. There's a sunspot cycle where, as you know, the spots get more numerous and less numerous, the storms increase. The sun gets a little brighter, especially in ultraviolet. But fewer people know that the magnetic polarity also reverses itself, and that's part of the process.
So we're at the solar max now, right? Or thereabouts?
We're at the solar max, and it's within the solar max that this happens. Where what really happens is that sunspots come in groups, usually two or more.
First of all, tell us what a sunspot is.
It's a darker place on the sun where the temperature is cooler than the rest. That's why it looks darker. It's cooler. And it's cooler because the magnetism is up to 3,000 times more intense locally in that spot. And that kind of squeezes and prevents material from down below from rising as fast. And it makes for a slightly cooler spot on that part of the sun. And every sunspot group has a magnetic polarity. As the sun rotates, the spot in the lead can be positive, and then the trailing spot is negative, and plasma, that is broken bits of atoms, follow these magnetic field lines and rise up from one place and go down to the other. Those are those from familiar, if you've looked at photos of the sun, loops of material.
Sure.
Okay, but in the other hemisphere, the northern hemisphere, the leading spot is not positive but negative, and the trailing spot is positive. So in other words, each hemisphere has an opposite polarity.
Right.
But once every 11 years, all of that changes. And now in the southern hemisphere, the leading spot isn't positive anymore, but negative, and the trailing spot is positive, and the opposite happens in the northern hemisphere. So the whole magnetic field of the sun changes. And unlike Earth, where our magnetic field is generated near the center of Earth, near our liquid the core that surrounds the solid core. In the sun, it comes from not the center of the sun, which is the H-bomb place. You can't get magnetism from that, but from a place about 70% out from the center. That's where the sun's magnetism is created. So a different process, really.
Well, as I understand it, and of course I understand very little, but as this is happening, the sun's magnetic field goes down to next to nothing. And well, then it goes, then it switches.
It switches, but it's more like a flickering. It's not really a nothing. You could picture the sun's magnetic field as it stretches out into space and it throws material out. It's like a lawn sprinkler. It's a spiral called the Parker spiral. You know how those rotating lawn sprinkles create this kind of spiral pattern? That's what the sun does. And there's also a lot of wrinkles and wobbles in it. And when the field flips, this gets a little chaotic for a while here and there. And when it gets chaotic, the sun's not as good as blocking cosmic rays from hitting Earth. And those are the real high energy things that can come into our atmosphere and affect us. So there's a brief period of time where the sun's not as effective a shield. But it's chaotic, it's brief, it flips, and it has never correlated with periods of bad things happening on Earth. So we don't really worry about it.
1-800-348-2551 is our number. Bob Berman is our guest. 1-800-348-2551. So you say sunspots are cooler. And to me that, and again, this is just my thinking, less stuff coming out, but why then is our radio propagation affected so much at the solar max? In other words, ham radio operators and everybody, they live for the solar max. So why, if there's less energetic parts on the sun, why does that correspond with more energy in our ionosphere?
Well, it's the sunspots themselves that are more numerous, and you can't say they're really less energetic because all in all, there's more storm activity. There's more coronal mass ejections throwing shotgun blasts of material, sometimes weighing as much as 50 billion tons in our direction. There are more prominences, flares, loops. The whole sun is wilder at that time. And sending stuff towards Earth, and stuff can be electromagnetic waves, it can be particles, affects our atmosphere, including the ionosphere. And that's why ham radio operators notice the change.
And broadcasters don't look forward to it at all. All right, let's go to the phones. We've been waiting long enough here. David in Johnstown, you're on with Bob Berman.
Terrible question, but I don't understand. Does light bend?
Okay.
Light can't bend as it travels.
It can't.
But if it's going through a region of space or the space itself has a warpage to it, then the light, of course, will follow the local space-time geometry and travel in a curved path.
I see. I thought that if we looked at the North Star, maybe the North Star is 20 degrees below us. That's what I know. I don't understand the theory, but it doesn't bend.
Well,
that's what you're saying.
Unless you're talking about our atmosphere, which bends light or refracts light, especially for objects near the horizon. In fact, objects very close to the horizon within half a degree bend by half a degree, and that's why when the sun looks like it's on the horizon, we're seeing a ghost, a phantom. It's not there. And this is what gives us about 5 minutes of undeserved sunshine every day. When the sun is on the horizon, it's actually already set, but we see it on the horizon because its image is being bent up from below the horizon.
Okay, thank you very much.
David, thanks a lot for getting us started here. It's 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Austin in Woodstock. Austin, you're on.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I had, two questions if there's time, but the first is age of the universe has been talked about recently, and I was wondering, how is that calculated, and how does that take into effect, if space and time are related, shouldn't the physics of, the near Big Bang time be all sorts of distorted, and shouldn't time be greatly affected by that?
Do you want to do the second question at once, because I'm scribbling down your question, or should we just do one at a time?
Okay. Second question was, I was just reading online, a lot of people have the vanishing sun problem. Like if the sun were, magically or whatever, to blink out of existence and, zero time, what would an observer on Earth notice about the gravity and the light and everything? And there seems to be a million different answers, but no one seems to have nailed anything down that I could find. So I was just wondering what your take on that was.
Okay, I never heard of that before, but I'll answer it. The first one about the age of the universe, well, it's mostly from the expansion of the universe. We see everything rushing away from everything else, so we could just extrapolate in reverse, taking into consideration the fact that the speed of the expansion changed about 7 billion years ago. And when you figure that together, you see that everything was at one point at one time, 13.7 billion years ago. But, or at least that's when light was able to travel across the universe. That's when the universe became transparent to light, 13.7 billion years ago. However, there's a problem with that, and that is that we can't really see very much of the universe. We see far less than 1% of it, and we may actually be only able to observe 0% of the universe, which means that we're extrapolating from very little data, and what we see may just be what we could call the observable universe, and the real universe beyond may not have any age at all. It may be eternal. It's probably infinite.
Okay.
Well, okay. Question number two.
Okay.
If the sun vanished?
Yeah.
If the sun vanished, well, that would be bad. you know, several things would happen. First, it would take about 8 minutes for us to even know that, because that's how long it takes the light from the sun to get here.
Yeah.
If the sun vanished, and I assume its gravity would vanish, we wouldn't keep circling around like idiots around empty space, so it would affect our orbit. We'd then move in a straight line instead of orbiting the sun, and generally, you know, life would change, and not for the better.
It would not be good, and that's a great happy spot to take a break. Zach, we'll take one now, 800-348-2551. Mr. Berman is here. We'll be back with more of your questions.
Support comes from Albany Institute of History and Art, presenting the making of the Hudson River School More Than the Eye Beholds. Now through August 18th, albanyinstitute.org. Binney Water Ice and Spring Water, Kingston. Pure Spring Water, Coffee Service, and Mountain Valley Spring Water delivered to homes and offices, local and family-owned. BinneyWater.com. New York State Canal Corporation, featuring Canal Splash, a weekend of activities and events in communities throughout New York's canal system. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, cruise the past, unlock the adventure. Canals.ny.gov. Boyden & Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts, and services to customers throughout Western Massachusetts, a family-owned business for over 50 years, boydenandperrin.com. And the Department of Theater Arts, SUNY New Paltz, offering a BA in Liberal Arts with career concentrations in design technology, theater studies, and performance, newpaltz.edu/theatre.
one 800 348 2551 is our telephone number. We've been talking a bit about the sun and the pending magnetic field flip the sun does once every 11 years. Our guest is astronomer Bob Berman. And, of course, the big news for this weekend, much closer to home, and that's the Perseids. It could be a good one, eh?
Oh, this should be a great Perseid meteor shower. Already I'm getting reports of many Perseids. You know, they've been underway since the end of July, Ray.
Yeah.
And it's just they increase in number, increase in number. They'll reach their peak on Sunday night after midnight. We're doing our usual Night of the Shooting Stars program at Mohonk Mountain House.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd love for everybody to come there, but you don't really need to, because it's just fine from your backyard anytime you have an open view of the sky. This year the moon is going to be harmless. This, you better grab it, because first, the weather forecast is, so far it's good. Of course, we all know that these are lying scum, and they're going to disappoint us. But,
nice.
I like Jason Goff and the others. These are actually, you know, the forecasts have, the content has really improved. I think they're really good.
Still, they'll even tell you in a candid moment that after 2 or 3 days, it's crapshoot.
Right, right. But
so,
let's hope it's clear.
Yeah.
Looks like it's going to be clear, and the moon is going to set early, and we're going to have dark skies, and that's good, because the next shower, usually the Geminids are really good on December 13th. Not this year. It'll be a full moon. Next year's Perseids are going to be washed out by a nearly full moon. So this is it. This is our one shot.
Perfect viewing if you get a clear sky. Dark.
Yep.
The darker, the better.
That's right. And face the northeast and get a wide expanse of sky. Don't try to just glance through trees or between houses.
Yeah.
And spread a blanket or a lawn chair. You don't want to crane your neck, keep your eyes glued upward, and after 11 o'clock, or especially after midnight, you should see one a minute.
Now, is this one of those where they come from a specific spot, or are you going to see it over a wide swath of the sky?
You'll see it over a wide swath, but if you trace the paths backward of each shooting star, they all seem to come from one spot, which will be in the northeast.
Okay. All right. And, you know, I was talking with somebody here at the office last week, and we were excitedly talking about this meteor shower, and this person said the same thing I've always thought. It seems like it should be the Leonids now. This is the time when Leo is, you know,
right.
In the horoscopes, it's Leo, or it was, you know, in late July. I guess it is still.
Well, yes. You know, horoscopes revolve around what constellation or what sign actually the sun is in, and the sun being in it means it's invisible.
Oh, yeah. All right. Okay. Let's go back to the phones. Jim in Middletown. Jim, you're on.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
I wanted to ask a question that I believe will be very easy for you. I wanted to put to bed something that has been passed along from parents and grandparents through the ages. They've told this to their children. We've all heard it. I wanted to simply ask, is it really true that when you stare up at the sun that you'll go completely blind?
There's been a lot of research into this, and at Astronomy Magazine, we have experts in both vision, that is, and I always mix it up whether these are ophthalmologists or, you know, there's names for eye doctors, so excuse my ignorance there, who are also sun experts, and they have all the data points to, here I'll get to the bottom line, there's been no case of a permanent retinal lesion of anyone staring at the sun for under about a minute and a half. So a quick look at the sun, we've all done it, and apparently, you know, if I say it's harmless, this is bad, attorneys won't.
No, like don't
me
say
saying
that.
This. So don't stare at the sun. But the truth is, you have to keep staring at the sun to develop a permanent damage to your eye. Our eyes are precious, so absolutely don't do it. You can damage your eyes. There was in a case of a man, for example, who was drinking and on a bet kept staring at the sun, and he developed a permanent retinal lesion. In his case, it was 3 minutes. It was timed. So we know that 3 minutes will do it. We know that a second or two won't do it. And so where in between that will be for your eyes, you don't want to be the guinea pig to find out.
No, you don't. All right. Well, Jim, that's a great question. And, you know, again, from a legal standpoint, we'll probably get a memo in a moment to do not do it. Do not do it. Dick in Lenox. Dick, you're on.
Hi. I'm going to switch my question because I think I got an answer to my question about infinity.
Okay.
And I'm going to switch it to, what's this business with a lunacy? What are we talking about when we talk about lunatics relating to the moon? Why do we talk about lunacy?
Well, it's a very interesting point. In one of my early books, I researched this to see if there was an increase in mental illness, that is, admissions to hospitals at around the time of the full moon. And as we all know, there's a psychogenic effect when people think something is going to affect them. It often does. And you often hear people say, who work in the medical profession, there are more births around the full moon. There are people who work in clinics who say, yeah, we get more patients, mental patients at the full moon. But actual studies show that there are no more calls to crisis centers or admissions to mental hospitals or those kind of that kind of data in any marching rhythm with lunar phase. Huh. So where...
Let me add a little bit. I understood an explanation for that was that somebody fell asleep in the moonlight and the polarized light penetrated their eyelids and they were temporarily blinded and then therefore they went bonkers.
That's funny, but can't be for two reasons. One, moonlight is not polarized. At least it's not highly polarized. It's barely polarized. And secondly, the intensity of moonlight is only 1/450,000th that of the sun. In other words, 450,000 full moons equal the light of the sun. So you couldn't possibly go blind no matter what you did staring at the moon. However, when people think that there's going to be an effect, they certainly see it. For example, again, this well-studied business of births and the moon. I'll tell you, maternity wing nurses will tell you, we see it. I don't care what you say. We see this every month. There's more. But what actually happens is that people will notice a full moon. Sometimes they'll even say, well, here we go. It's a full moon. And if there are more births, if it is a busy time, they'll go, oh, see, told you.
Couldn't it be gravity?
No.
Like a tidal thing?
No,
it's time. The baby's coming now.
It doesn't exist. If we had more time for this, I could give you the studies. There's one in 1958, one in 59.
Interesting.
Big studies, one in France involving 3 million births. There's been a lot of data on this.
Go ahead, Dick.
I'm a dentist, and I thought that we had more toothaches on a full moon. Matter of fact, we charted it for a while, and it seemed to pan out.
Wow. Because you have to chart it for a long time, right?
Yeah, we probably didn't do it long enough, but we did chart it for a while. I got a kick out of it.
Well, I'll be darned. Well, thanks for the call. I appreciate it very much. Okay, Bill in Half Moon. Bill, you're on with Bob Berman.
Hi, great program.
Thank you.
My question is about the comet Ison. I was reading an article about it, and I'm wondering whether you had any updates on it as to what's happening or what might happen.
Well, I'm very invested in it because we're bringing at least two groups sequentially down to Chile. You don't have to go to Chile to see it, by the way, but we're going down to Chile yeah. because in the period before it reaches its closest point to the sun, that is before perihelion, it'll pass around the sun around Thanksgiving. And then it should be, if it survives that very close passage, just 800,000 miles above the sun, only a sun width above the sun, it should be very, very beautiful in the first week of December from here. However, we're bringing about 80 people down to the Atacama Desert in the Andes to catch it before it reaches perihelion, to be among the first to see it. And just in case the sun destroys it, we want to see it first. So we're all interested in, is Ison going to live up to the hype? And I've advised everybody, don't even pay attention to that, because comets are so unpredictable that they'll brighten up for a while, then they'll not brighten up. 1 month, it'll look like it's fizzling out. Another month, they'll say, no, it's getting brighter than we even think it's going to be, because you really can't predict how a first-time comet entering the inner solar system, how those ices are going to react to the heat of the sun. The ice, I would like to say melt, but you can't have liquid in space, so it turns to gas. It sublimates, and it releases the dust, and the dust gets pushed back by the sun, and so you get a tail. But how much dust is released, and how will it react? And the truth is, nobody knows, and we're not going to know until the comet actually essentially gets here.
Okay, and when does it get here?
November is when it'll brighten. December, if it survives its perihelion passage at the end of November, is when it should be at its best here.
Okay, so we here can see it before it passes by the sun.
You can. However, it'll only be seen before dawn, before perihelion, and it'll be seen after sunset in the evening sky, much more convenient, in early December after it comes by the sun.
You had mentioned, and by the way, the number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You mentioned in your answer to our last caller that it's a first-timer, but it was here long ago, right? This is just the first time we know.
Well, in this particular case, it has orbital characteristics that look like a beautiful comet in the 17th century. We once thought that they're part of the same parent body. Now we think they weren't. But there's something weird about this one that looks like it was pushed and may have been jostled into its present orbit. So it could be the first time that it's visited us, or it could be, you know, a 30,000-year orbit. In any case, there's no predicting what it's going to do.
So there's no way of extrapolating where it's going and how far it will go?
Yeah, well, when it goes way out the way it does, this is not like Comet Halley, which has a 76-year period and only goes as far as the planet Uranus and comes back.
Yeah.
This has a path that's closer to a parabola. So this goes way out and just barely comes back again.
How far out? You know, way beyond.
Yeah, way beyond. Not to the nearest star, but you could say into interstellar space.
Well, what pulls it back? In other words, if it's beyond the point where the sun has any effect.
Right. Well, it still has an effect because if it's a very eccentric ellipse, not quite a parabola, but an ellipse, even though it's stretched out and thin and goes slower and slower and it's weaker and weaker gravity, there's still something there and it'll still be attached to us.
Wow. Let's go back to the phones now. And Michael in Albany. Michael, you're on.
Hey there.
Hey.
My question has to do with electricity and the sun and coronal mass ejections.
Okay.
If like charges repel, and if we can with any predictability predict the charge of a coronal mass ejection, then can we set the hull of a ship's voltage to match that, thereby repelling it from the coronal mass ejection and using that as a way to transport us to the solar system?
Well, I like your thinking. This is certainly this is cool and original. We don't know the charge of a coronal mass ejection. And just to define it for our listeners who don't know what this is a big blast of material from the sun. It could weigh 10 billion tons. It comes here at a speed that can approach 1,000 miles a second and get here in as little as 2 days, usually 2.5 or 3 days. Okay, so on the way here, it has its own charge, as you said. With magnetic north up and south down, or the other way around. But you can't tell it. There's no way we can tell unless it's physically measured, and the nearest spacecraft that can do that is a kind of a long-in-the-tooth aging spacecraft called SOHO that's located about 1 million miles sunward of us. Only when those particles sweep past the spacecraft can its polarity be measured, and that only gives us a few hours of notice before it gets here. And then, incidentally, once it reaches Earth, it will transfer its energy to Earth only if its magnetic field is aligned opposite ours. If the magnetic field, and it's a 50-50 chance, is aligned the same as ours, then our own magnetosphere harmlessly channels this material around us, past us, and into space, and it doesn't influence us at all.
But so, a spaceship, then, theoretically, that was, going back to Michael's idea, that was charged in an opposite way from the coronal mass ejection, then could it be propelled?
Just from physics, it would seem unlikely to get much of an oomph from it, because remember, these particles, you could have at most 100 particles, and we're talking about each one the size of a proton per cubic centimeter, and that's not very much. That's still very close to a vacuum. So even if it has its charge, there's not a lot of oomph to that.
Right,
we're not talking about anything that even would approach a refrigerator magnet. And so to change the trajectory of a spacecraft or to give it like a push, I don't think it would be there.
Okay. Nice idea, though. I've never even heard that thought of before. Michael, thank you for the call.
Thank you, guys.
Appreciate it. Let's go to Irene and Saugerties. Irene.
Hi. My name's Irene. I'm no longer from Saugerties, but when I used to live there, Jean Rolson was a famous poet. I don't know if Bob remembers her, but she wrote this poem about, in the olden time, women used to put their stained linens out in the snow, and the snow and the moonlight would bleach it. Has Bob ever heard anything like that on those properties? And thank you.
Okay, thank you for that. What bleaches the moonlight and the snow?
Is that possible? Is that true, or was that just poetic license on Jean's part?
Ray, did you understand that? What bleaches? Are we talking about moonlight on the snow?
Moonlight and yeah.
And then what?
Getting stains out of clothing.
Getting stains out of clothing.
Yeah.
Is that what you said? You mean, in other words,
you'd put
stains outdoors in the snow when it's in the moon, and it would take the stains off.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I never heard anything like that. Moonlight does, to many people, look like a bluish cast on the snow, and there's a reason for that, only because our eyes can only see greenish blue at low light levels.
Yeah.
So by the light of the moon, all the other colors are there, but we only see the bluish green. And so moonlight has a bluish green artificial cast to it, because that's all we're perceiving. I don't have to tell you that I don't see any mechanism. I mentioned earlier that moonlight is 450,000 times fainter than sunlight, and sunlight is powerful enough, I guess, to bleach clothing, but
sure,
it would be hard to see how moonlight would be.
Well, thank you, Bob.
But it's
appreciate
a nice poetic
you.
Thought.
That's a great
you know?
Thought, yeah. And if it worked, I mean, gosh, you could really save money on detergent. Ivan in Kinderhook, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
My question, I was down by Bainbridge, New York, along the Susquehanna-Delaware Rivers. And they have a lot of historical markers down there where
It seems as though there have been flooding down there since the early 1800s that's documented. And I don't know if this is down your alley, but how does adaptation, like evolution, take place when there's so much change? Well, don't you need a kind of a consistent environment? It seems like our environment is not that consistent in order to allow evolution to take place when there's always a change. As I get older, I just notice that we're not very consistent with our environment. It's always changing.
Well, these are great thoughts. You know, it's outside my field of astronomy, so I'm always tempted to make up some answer and pretend that I know stuff outside my field, but I really
right.
Don't.
That would make you a broadcaster and not an astronomer, actually. All right. Well, Ivan, I'm sorry. I guess we can't help you there. We can't help you with the cleaning of clothes in the moon. And let's just take a break, Zach. I'm at a loss here.
Support comes from Don Muller Gallery, Northampton, Massachusetts, specializing in jewelry, custom designs, handcrafted glass, and gifts by American artists since 1978. Facebook and donmullergallery.com. Charles Padula DDS, Union Avenue, Schenectady, providing comprehensive, minimally invasive dentistry to the whole family. PaduladDS.com. Cafe Capriccio, Chef Jim Rua, working to preserve and maintain the traditions of Italian cuisine and hospitality since 1982 on Grand Street in Albany, New York. CafeCapriccio.com. Joyelle's Jewelers, Delmar, New York, specializing in custom jewelry and repair, laser welding, designer jewelry, and gifts. JoyellesJewelers.com. And Bethel Woods Center for the Arts, presenting cellist Yo-Yo Ma, Stuart Duncan, Edgar Myers, and Chris Thiele in the Goat Rodeo Sessions with guest vocalist Aoife O'Donovan, Friday, August 16th at 8. BethelWoodsCenter.org.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Astronomer Bob Berman is with us. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. So earlier in the show, we had a caller who talked about lunacy and the origins of that word and sort of the myths and the facts behind strange occurrences when the moon is full. And you had mentioned a study in France in the 50s where there were 3 million births.
Yeah, that was the biggest one. And there was one in New York City in 1958 done by a father and son physician team of 500,000 births, Menninger and Menninger. So because of the large study, they used all the public hospitals in New York and found a 1% difference in birth rate between the time of the month when the moon was bright and when it was dark. A follow-up study did not show that same effect, but combined, it didn't match with the full moon, but it matched with the brightness of the moon versus the half when it
was. So it was not the full moon where tides are
right.
A big. You know, I thought it could have been a tidal thing. In other That's words, right. if a woman is about to give birth or close, maybe there's some last little trip mechanism that the full moon could just
well, that
say,
would be,
you know, it's
that
time.
Would be fascinating if other studies, such as the ones in France and elsewhere, supported that. But all those other studies were all over the place showing either no effect on birth or a different phase of the moon. So taken all in all, in fact, Psychology Today, a magazine, some years ago did a meta-analysis of all the various lunar birth studies and found no effect at all on this. One reason you talked about gravity is that the actual gravity from the physician attending the birth is greater than what you'd get from the moon, even when the moon varies from one phase to another.
Interesting.
So there doesn't seem to be anything there. And we wouldn't expect it to be because, first of all, why only humans? Then we'd see it in the animal kingdom, too.
Yeah.
But there are some intriguing things. Why is the human menstrual cycle so close to the synodic period of the moon? The moon's period of phases is 29 and a half days, and it turns out that the average menstrual cycle is much closer to that than the 28 days that is often cited. On the other hand, the only other animal that has a similar estrous cycle is the opossum. So
the opossum. Really?
So then we'd have to believe that only humans and opossums are linked to the moon in this way and no other animals are. But let's say humans are. It makes kind of more sense that maybe we're linked, not because of anything that's happening now, but our history. Because there was a time, Ray, when moonlight was very important, where if you went out on a date, if you were courting from your cave or wherever you lived, and it was a dark of the night, dark of the month, there were predators out there that had a lot better nocturnal eyesight than humans did.
Yeah.
And it was a dangerous time, whereas in the bright full moon period, you could see, you could maybe see enemies. And so maybe our courtships, maybe our are linked in that way, and we still have a legacy of this.
I've always had more success in the dark. I don't know. Let's go to Mike in Boston. Mike.
Yes, this is Mike. I'm.
You're in Boston?
Well, I'm in hour two of a 1,000-mile drive, and I just picked up your radio station.
Cool. Well, welcome aboard. You're on with Bob Berman.
Well, I heard you talking about, as I came on, I heard you talking about the comet that was getting ready to whip around the sun.
Yep,
I saw it. And I was wondering if we had been prepared, or if we were prepared, if we could tag that comet somehow and either use it to broadcast a SETI signal as it goes out into the universe, or maybe identify it when it comes back into the solar system in 20, 30,000 years.
That's a great idea. Reaching it would not be easy, because even when it approaches Earth at its closest, which will be some weeks after its perihelion passage in December, it's going to be only as close to us as the planet Mars. So it's not coming particularly close to Earth. Secondly, I don't know how you tag a comet, because remember, it's surrounded by ices, and these ices sublimate. They turn to gas each time. So what's going to be left, and where would you find this stuff the next time around? And so it'd be easier said than done, I would think.
It would be fun, though.
It would be fun.
And expensive.
Yeah.
But let's hope it lives up to our hopes and expectations. Comet ISON could really give us something great to see come November and December.
I'll be looking for it.
Mike, have a safe trip, all right?
All right, thank you.
Thanks a lot. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Bob Berman is our guest. Always fun to have Bob here. And it's Kathleen in Saugerties. Kathleen, you're on.
Hello. I'm enjoying this show so much, your repartee with each other and carrying on.
Well, thank you.
So, my question is, because I just watched a group of DVDs of pictures that were taken from the Hubble telescope, and actually it just blew my mind to be watching this. So I wanted to know if you had seen it. I think it was the teaching company did a whole thing with a professor talking on astrophysics. Anyhow, you can get it out of the library at Ulster County Library. But what discovery really surprised you, Bob Berman, because you're out there in space.
He certainly is.
He's out there. So what was so exciting for you?
Well, the whole thing's been exciting. The big thing about Hubble is its sharpness, not its ability to really see deeper into space, because its mirror is only 94 inches across, so it's not a particularly large telescope. But because it's above our atmosphere, it's so detailed that it can show us planetary views that almost rival those of spacecraft that go to the planets. And the Hubble Deep Field, I think that was really fascinating, because someone convinced the Hubble people down in Baltimore to let the telescope stare for 100 hours. That's an awful lot of time to give up for the telescope at just one little tiny speck of the sky near the Big Dipper, a speck that was only as large as a grain of sand held at arm's length. So by looking that way, we got our deepest field sense of what the universe is like, with the greatest definition and depth we've ever had before. And then another one was done in the Southern Hemisphere, and that let us survey these things to a greater extent than we've ever had before. I'd say the deepest questions, though, that Hubble has raised have proved to be mysterious. So it's made us more aware of how little we know cosmologically than we did when it was initially launched. And that's kind of sobering.
Yeah. Thank you. I think everybody should rent that little set from the library. It's amazing.
Well, Kathleen, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye. So the Deep Field Project, how did they pick that one little rice-sized speck?
It was picked because we wanted not to look through our own Milky Way. We wanted a clear view, like a clear window beyond our galaxy into intergalactic space. And when you look towards the Big Dipper, you're looking almost at right angles to the Milky Way. You know, these nights at around midnight, you'll see the Milky Way bisecting the sky. But when you look to, in that direction of the Milky Way, you see it's kind of a lonelier section. There are fewer stars because there's fewer foreground Milky Way galaxy stuff. And
yeah.
So it's an emptier, more perfect view out to the rest of the universe.
So what did it find? What were the big discoveries?
Well, one of them was how many spiral galaxies are in the distance relative to elliptical and irregular galaxies. And we learned that the younger universe, because the farther out in space we see, the older we're looking, had more spirals. And apparently there is an evolution that spiral galaxies collide and become football-shaped or spherical galaxies over time.
Interesting. 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Fred in Sullivan County, it's your turn.
Yes, hi. Always a great show when Bob is there.
Thank you.
Two things in reference to earlier callers, one on the moon and one on the sun.
Okay.
I have family and friends in law enforcement, and the sheriff of one of the counties in the southern tier, I asked him a question several years ago about whether crimes, you know, bizarre crimes or robberies or this or that, were more prevalent when there was a full moon. And his answer, which sounds like a common sense answer, is he said when the moon is full, the criminals can see better. They don't need flashlights.
Well,
so
that,
there may be something to that.
Was he serious?
No, I think he was serious. But I asked a few other, you know, lesser a lieutenant and a sergeant more recently, and they claimed that there were more crimes during a full moon. So I don't know which is right, but they both sound right to me.
Well, there's been one study that I saw, an actual study looking for crime and lunar phase. That was done in Dade County, Florida, which I guess is a good place to look for crime statistics and the moon. And it found no correlation. I'm convinced now that anytime you have two events and human beings together, we'll tend to link them. For example, if the phone seems to ring just as you're sitting down to dinner each night,
right,
that's not going to escape your attention. You're going to be very sensitized to that. You'll be aware of every time it happens, and you'll kind of ignore the dinners where it doesn't happen. And over time, you're going to convince yourself that for some crazy reason, people call more often during dinner time. So whenever you, and here are two events, crime for a law enforcement officer who's aware of it, and the full moon. We're aware of those times that they seem to be linked, and then we just don't think about it those times that it's either cloudy and we don't see the moon, or the moon is at some other phase, but there are more crimes, and we just don't do anything with that at all with our minds. So over time, it's human nature to make a connection, and the only thing that shows us whether it's spurious or whether it's real are good statistical studies with control groups, and that tells us what's what.
All right.
Right.
You had
right.
something about the sun as well?
Yes, but I thought it was a common sense answer, though, you being able to see better in a full moon. But
true, but maybe you know, by another argument, maybe brightness would deter criminals.
That's true too. No, something helpful as far as staring at the sun or a bright light. When I was very young, learning to weld, arc weld, I didn't look through the dark glass because I was trying to strike a bead with the electrode, and I burned my eyes. I mean, I just an hour or two afterward, I just couldn't see. My eyes watered, and everything was white.
Oh my goodness!
And my father, who had a background in as an engineer and he knew how to weld, and apparently this was an old wives' remedy. That when he got home, he cut a potato in half. And I put the halves of the potatoes on my eye with a wet washcloth, and within an hour or two, my vision was just fine. So maybe that's a little homework for the science panel.
I'm glad for you. I'm glad it wasn't permanent.
We got a science forum next week. Could you please call us back with that one?
Okay, why not?
Fred, thanks a lot.
Sure thing, bye.
Well, that was interesting. 1-800-348-2551. You know, I see your point exactly about two events and humans wanting to link them. But a case like that where there was a sheriff of a southern tier county, clearly it's not one event. It's a lifetime of experience. Is there not more validity to that?
I don't know.
All right. Fair enough. 1-800-348-2551 is the I can't engage you in an argument today. You're in a good mood. Let's go to Penny in Richmond. Penny, you're on with Bob Berman. Well, I don't want to hit the button, Ray, you nitwit. There we go. Penny, you're on.
Oh, hi there. I have a question about black holes. I'm just wondering about their existence and if they're real, and if so, if you could just talk a little bit about what they are.
Well, it's actually comes from the 18th century when two astronomers independently realized that just following Isaac Newton's gravity, you could have something collapsing, a star, that if it got smaller, the gravity at the surface would get stronger inversely with the square of its size, and that would implode it even smaller, which would increase the gravity on its surface, which would implode it smaller, and this could become a runaway contraction, resulting in the gravity getting so great that not even light could escape. And so even back then, even though it was never called black holes, it was John Wheeler who coined the term black hole, and that was only in the 1960s, I believe. And it was only a little after that we found the first one, Cygnus X1, surrounding a star named HDE226868. Catchy name, I'll never forget it, because here we have a star in Cygnus the Swan. It's out these nights, a little star that's being whirled around an empty space. And the only thing that can whirl a massive star, we found out this star weighs more than 10 times that of the sun. The only thing that can hurl a star around like a sumo wrestler would be something even heavier. But the problem is, the heavier a star is, the brighter it is. And here we have nothing. There's nothing visible. Secondly, we have X-rays coming from that spot. And third, the X-rays flicker in a very rapid time scale. Now, all those things are evidence for a black hole, because a black hole should whip things around. It should be small. It should produce X-rays when material spirals in, and the X-rays should flicker. So all the evidence was there. And so this star, this little tiny blue star, eighth magnitude star, you'd need binoculars to see it, HDE 226868, whatever it's going around, came to be called Cygnus X1, X1 meaning the first and brightest X-ray source in Cygnus the Swan, and that became, and still is, our surest black hole candidate. So what they are is an object that has collapsed, been pulled in, imploded to the place where, at its surface, the warpage of space-time is so great that light can never find a path out, and light rays curve back on themselves. And so there's a lot of evidence that these things really exist.
All right. I think we lost Penny might have been engaged in another conversation as well. So the star is spinning rapidly around this black hole, first black hole.
In this case, a little under a week.
Does it ever get to the point where it goes in, or is it just perpetually in that spot?
When we see it, it's perpetually there, because the black hole, after all, doesn't increase its gravity, so it's a stable orbit around the black hole. Just as we have in the massive black hole that we have in the center of our galaxy. Now, we're talking about something that doesn't weigh 20 suns. It weighs 4 million suns at the core of the Milky Way galaxy. We see some stars that are in orbit around it in a period that's so fast, we're talking about just a few years, that indicates that here is a massive collapsed object with 4 million solar masses worth of material. So they can come in almost any size.
And now conventional wisdom is that there is one at the center of every galaxy?
Yes.
And is it the engine that runs the galaxy keeps it
moving?
Well,
we don't know what came first, chicken or egg kind of thing. But yeah, I don't know of a single galaxy that doesn't have a supermassive black hole in the core. In the case of some galaxies like M87, it can weigh as much as 8 billion suns.
Wow.
Really supermassive.
That is big.
Black hole.
All right. Well, Bob Berman, always great to have you here. And if you're listening at home, I would recommend you're going to hear stuff about the sun's magnetic field flipping. And I recommend you go and pick up Bob's book, which is The Sun's Heartbeat. It is in paperback now. It's the same imprint, right? But in paperback? Little Brown?
Yes.
Okay. And if you'd like to join us here, you can always email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And we thank everybody for tuning in today. And sorry if you didn't make it through. Always good to call early. Support comes from the Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, protecting New York's historic buildings, districts, and landscapes since 1974. PreserveNYS.org. The Arkell Museum at Canajo Harry, presenting An American in Venice, James McNeil Whistler and His Legacy, with etchings by Whistler, John Marin, and more. ArkellMuseum.org. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. And Rhinebeck Artist Shops, Rhinebeck at New Paltz, providing professional picture framing, fine art materials, and now open the Atwater Art Gallery in Rhinebeck, atwatergallery.com. That's it for the program today. Zach Malloy was at the controls. Our phones answered by Hannah Hohenstein Flack, and our producer today, well, newly on board, it's Jessica Blaustein Marshall. Nice to have her here. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's Moyers and Company at this time. And on Monday, Alan will be back. It's a medical Monday. Have a lovely weekend. Stay tuned for a news update.
This is Northeast Public Radio, WAMC FM HD 90.3 Albany, WRUN HD 90.3 RIMS.